You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest on today's pod is Adam Morgan, who is the Director of Brand Marketing at Twilio, where he leads global brand strategy for one of the world's most influential developer-first technology companies. His work focuses on making complex infrastructure brands culturally relevant by blending creativity, clarity, and storytelling at scale. He is the author of Sorry Spock, Emotions Drive Business. You're going to enjoy the pod. Adam Morgan, welcome to the podcast.
So great to be here.
Your book on creative ideas came out in 2019, and you say in the book very early on, quote, "I want to prove that creative ideas work better," end quote. I wonder if you feel that the advertising and marketing industries have made any progress whatsoever since then, since the book came out. Have we gotten better at this?
You know, the short answer is no. And the reason why is I think it's just there are a lot of us creative types who train our brains by people watching, reading stories, learning about story arc, like just all the things that we fill our heads with that help us kind of be more attuned to creativity and emotions predominantly. But I think it's just this constant flow of folks who go to school or get an MBA and just train their brain to focus on the nuances of numbers and finance and statistics. And so it's an endless opportunity, let's call it, for us to help them see that emotions are not scary and they're not bad for business, but they're actually really, really good for the bottom line.
It's funny, too, because whenever I'm brought into like an innovation or creativity conference and I get asked the inevitable question of what's the biggest barrier to creativity, my answer is always past success, because once you have a formula and once you have a system, it really is hard not to go back to it because it worked once. And as you know, like it never works twice or three times. I mean, you are like, you have to do things are different, which means then you have to step out of your comfort zone. And boy, do we not want to do that.
No, I will say this though, circumstantially, we're in a good era right now for storytelling and branding, in the sense that, you know, for years and years, performance marketing was all the rage, and it was, you know, it was the princess. And now branding and storytelling is getting a little bit more limelight because of AI, because AI has come in and leveled the playing field. And now everyone can put on a high glossy production something. But then the question begs the question of, what do you stand for? What's your story? What's your why? And what is the brand? Because that's what's going to differentiate you anymore today. So that's why we're experiencing a good little kind of emotional brand moment right now. And just because of AI, which is kind of interesting, not in spite of it.
Well, yeah, that's interesting, because obviously in the creative industries, the fear of AI is through the roof. And yes. I see it. I mean, obviously, like you're not going to see AI doing comedy shows at Second City. Like,
although that would be interesting if you put one up on there and tried to train it to riff off stuff. I don't even know how it would go.
I think we all know how that would go. I mean, because in general, what we know about comedy is it relies on the surprise that it's usually the wrong thing that is funny. And the one thing AI is not good at is like using wrong things.
And because it's looking for established patterns, and if a pattern stays established, I'm telling you, it's not going to be funny, and also not necessarily be creative. One of the things that I love is how you start the book. You talk in the chapter one of the book. You say, "Quote: When presenting ideas, the classic rule of three is important." End quote. I've worked in the comedy field my whole life. I know about the rule of three. But can you talk about that, and then how that worked in your pitch to your client, Russell Fisher, which starts the book?
Yeah. So the rule of three, and here's what's interesting. As I've pitched many, 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 many times work and ideas over the years, there's something funny about if you pitch too many ideas, like if you get up to like 5, 6, 7 ideas, and normally people would think, oh, that's great. Show that you've got a lot more flexibility or ideas out there. No, all the ideas die. Mm-hmm. If you get too high, they're all dead. And so I've always just kept that mantra. Like if you can keep around three, maybe a fourth if it's, you know, a reasonable audience. But almost always when you get too many ideas for the short list, they all die. So if you try and show your work and be like, look, I came up with 100 ideas, their brain will melt and they won't be able to see and understand the nuance and differences, and it'll just blur together and it's dead. So that was the important part of that pitch session, is just keep it to a few simple ideas and that's it.
I'm a little obsessed with the numbers as they relate to creativity. And Rod Friedman has a new book on super teams. And he talks about the fact that collective decision-making, once you get beyond 6 people or 7 people, just goes like into the toilet with the addition of 100%, every other person.
100%. Yes. If you've ever been on a vacation with an extended family, you know, you do not give them choices.
Yeah. And 6 is this ideal number. And I'm like, well, that's ironic given the fact that Second City casts have been predominantly 6 people for 67 years. It's like, and we've done 5 person shows and there's been the occasional 7 person cast, and it's never quite as sweet as it is with that 6. And then other studies are talk about that being sort of ideal for teams, because you start to get beyond like 10 and it's like you have no control at that point. Mm-hmm. And you can't really mentor that many people.
Oh, I love this. I want to get this book. I'll have to get this
teams
afterwards.
Ron Friedman. He's terrific. He's going to be one of my next guests on the podcast. You talk about agencies as being mostly either a creative agency or a strategic agency. I actually don't think that's changed. That feels like very much a thing. So explain to our audience what that means in terms of the industry you're in, and what the tension is between those two things, and why it's sort of a false equivalency.
Yeah, it really is just about what are they really, really good at when it comes down to the agency expertise. And I think every agency wants to think that they're good at everything. And even when I was in it for 20 years, you know, it's like, that's what you pitch. Yeah, we can do it all. We gotcha. But the reality is some, and it's funny, it doesn't even, maybe it's because of how the agencies cultivate and hire specific types of people, or like you said, they get into their sweet spot. And so they just kind of keep repeating those patterns as whoever comes in. But a lot of times it has to do with the talent, but they're either really good at finding that funny emotional kind of connection, the creativity, or the flip side of it, which is the strategy, where, to be honest, is still a version of creativity, but it's more of like looking at the problem from a more analytical point of view rather than an emotional point of view. And so some agencies are really great. Like I could go hire an agency today and they may come in and be like, we've analyzed the audience. We know exactly all of their nits and pieces and parts. And here's some tactical advantages of what you could do. And that's more like the strategy thing. And then they'll present the actual creative work and it looks very derivative and boring. And it's like, ugh, right? Or you go to the creative agency and they have hilarious, fun ideas. Like it's just so good. But strategically, like they're not necessarily on the brief, or they're not necessarily following the right audience. They don't really understand the product, but they've got a funny idea. So it's always been this challenge of, it's hard to get it all perfect. And you certainly can try, but agency or just businesses in general fall into one of those camps.
So the problem you've got is out of those two, the strategy, the data, that's going to win for the most part, because someone can look at it and hold it in their hand and understand what it is. Unfortunately, and you talk about this in the book, and it's my experience as well, if you don't tap in to the emotional aspect, you're missing truth.
100%.
And if you're missing truth, you are not making a real human connection with the human being. And then the bad thing about that on the other side is, like, you can have all the truth in the world, but if it's not making it into the hands of the consumer. So you need both. And that is a very rare bird to find someone who can live in both worlds. And this is the thing from reading your book where I'm like, oh, this is what you and I have in common. Like, I have been a strategic creative business leader at Second City since 1992. So, like, my job has always been as a bridge in terms of, like, how what is the talent saying? How is that working? And then I have to talk to suits who have the money. And I love that. To me, being able to dip your toe in both worlds is fantastic. And also, I think because it's unusual, it's sort of, you can kind of carve out your spot. And it seems like that's a thing you've been doing for as long as I've been doing it.
Oh, yeah. It's funny how you bring that up. I've often over the years said I'm a central brainer, which is a total lie. There's no such thing as a central brain, which is hilarious. But it is true. It's like I started out deep in the sciences, studying to be a chemical engineer in college. You know what I mean? Like, because it was all about the science. But then I looked at creativity from a different angle. And much of my career was like breaking it apart and be like, okay, how can I craft the perfect headline or the perfect TV spot? And I studied hundreds and hundreds of one show books and, you know, award shows and all these things just to find those little nuances. I mean, it was just like, I took like a scientific approach to it. But then at some point I had to just like let that all go and go more for the feeling. Like, does this feel right? Does this feel like it's going to connect? Does this tap into nostalgia, or is it funny, or is it whatever? So it's just been that whole world correct of like, how do you look? And that's what the book is. How do you look at creativity with a scientific approach? Like, how do you balance both those things? Because what's interesting in the book, I don't know if you remember this part, is that people see that, like, you're right. Like, the leaders are only going to ask for the logic and the data, and they're not going to be, you know, upfront asking for the creativity. But when you really, really break it down and look at it from a neuroscience perspective, logic and emotion are the same things. They're just different concentrations. Mm-hmm. Like, emotion is the way that the brain does a fast track of bringing back a whole bunch of memories, versus logic is the slow track, you know, the slow system of like creating a new memory. And so people are always like, they've got to be opposites and fight against each other. And that's not true at all. What you need to do is, that's why emotion is so powerful, is because it's a hell of logic, right? All concentrated into one little quick dopamine hit, right? And so if you can figure that out and use that emotion, like, you're getting all the data and then some that you could ever want in one little fast kind of delivery mechanism.
What was fascinating to me when I learned about you and your work and then read the book was that looking at the time period, the time you were writing about this intersection of creativity and science was the exact time where we were working at the University of Chicago at the Booth School of Business with Richard Thaler and others to develop a thing called the Second Science Project, which was a 4-year program that looked at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation and vice versa. We literally were on campus every single week, and we were doing experiments there and at Second City and creating bespoke exercises. And what it was doing, it was fascinating because it's I'll give you one example. One of the things that we know and we teach and have taught forever at Second City and in improvisation is the need to be others focused, you know. And what does that mean? It's like, well, you need to really, we mostly focus on ourselves. When you focus on the other person, you're going to learn more. There's mirroring that happens and reciprocal stuff that happens, and that's all good. And I'm like, great. So we all agree on that. But the scientists take it a step further. And Heather Caruso, who is my partner in crime up at the university, introduced me to William Swan, who was a professor who had a paper that he developed and an idea called self-verification theory. And I just remember sitting around this table and I'm like, pardon me, Heather, explain to me what this is. And she says, well, you know how you probably think people want to be seen as their best selves, their prettiest selves, their smartest selves. She goes, that's actually not true, is what Swan says. What Swan says is that people want to be seen as they see themselves. So if I see myself as clumsy, it's important that you see me as clumsy so you won't throw me a ball, but I'm not going to tell you.
Interesting.
So this idea of like, oh, how do I get to know how someone sees themselves? There's one way, and that's asking a lot of questions and allowing them to reveal themselves over time, which builds trust and builds community. And I'm like, that is a layer deeper. And it led us to sort of explore in these sort of bespoke improvisational exercises and into the work that we're doing on stage today, how do we get to know an audience at that other level? Because as you know, with focus groups and other things like that, for the most part, people are going to tell you what they think you want to hear.
Yeah, they're a bunch of liars is what they are.
Yeah, they're a bunch of liars. I guess that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
So this thing that we're doing right now downstairs, and I've talked about this a couple times because it's a brand new show. My wife, Anne, is directing, and Anne led that program up at the University of Chicago. It's the Second City ETC. It's called Reality Detox. It opens next week. But the first 15 minutes of the show, the cast is in the audience carrying on rather deep conversations with audience members. Not that anyone else can hear, except for who might be sitting around them. And they come on stage and they talk about those conversations, and those get weaved in throughout.
Oh, I love it.
The evening. So there was one woman the other night. It turns out earlier, she was an older woman, but earlier in her life, she did roller derby. And it wasn't until late in the second act when two of the actresses were in the audience starting to do roller derby. And everyone knew, and they remembered it. And it became this like really like powerful moment. And what Anne has talked about with me is what's happening is the cast is imprinting themselves on the audience, but the audience is imprinting themselves on the cast. That's what's really unique in an improv show context, which is not something that I've seen a bunch. And it's how cool at 67 years, we're able to still play with this format and make these discoveries and delight people. And the reason I think they're delighted also is it's like the anti-AI show. It's only happening that night. It only could happen that night. We're in that room. There's no devices.
Yeah. Well, the beauty of that is like what emotion does is it's a shared context, right? It's like normally as a comedian, you're probably trying to pull from whatever the most common denominator of information that people understand and know to turn it into fun jokes. Whereas this awesome experience is adding that extra layer of detail and data that's bringing more emotional connection because it's a shared moment just from 5 minutes ago, which is pretty awesome. Oh, I love it.
So like, I'm curious, and you talk about in the book, and it's widely studied, how we fall off this creative cliff as we get older. And unfortunately, it starts very young. We could be 5, 6, 7, and suddenly, our options become much more limited. We're not taught in our educational system to think creatively in that sort of world. It just gets worse when you get into business. How did you fight? I know how I fought it. And I was very lucky, youngest of six boys. My dad was a theater guy. I was exposed to like all different kinds of work, whether it was new film and music and art and that, so I had this world that was constantly feeding me new stuff and encouraging me to do that. How'd you, carry on this battle to not be the drone that others are?
I think, for me, I didn't have that same support system. So lucky you that you had all of that. But I just know, like in the mid-90s, I just fell in love with ideas. Mm-hmm. I think that just kind of big ideas, fun ideas, just bold ideas. It was just this thing that just fueled me so much. And so for me, often I'll say on my podcast, if you want to lead, you have to read. And so for me, it's been a matter of reading or going back and taking courses or going, listening to new podcasts. Like to me, it's all about, can I find those new nuggets of a new idea that really spark me and keep me alive? So that's kind of how I've done it. And also like, you're doing a podcast here, you're getting exposed to so many different people and ideas. And that's what it is for me. Like I'm into year 7 of Real Creative Leadership. And it's just meeting creative people in all these different companies and walks of life, and just their ideas, that just thrills me. That's what keeps me alive.
So one of our podcasts not too long ago was with Joe Pine, who folks know from the experience economy. He coined that term. And his latest book is he's moved, not that they moved on from, but scaled that idea to what he calls now the transformation economy. And what I loved about that, which is at its core at Second City with improvisation, is we are seeking to transform ourselves and audiences, and so that it is not enough to have a great experience. It's like, well, then what about that experience has changed you? It's the idea of, like, you're going home and you're laughing and thinking about it, and then you sort of reflect of something maybe important that happened. And you know, this is obviously something that's been key in your world. I think that it's become, it's with the advent of social media, it wasn't as salient for us. I don't know that you can transform now in a variety of ways. And so I wonder how that has worked for you, moving from experience to transformation and perhaps back and forth.
I'll say one of the biggest transformations that I am a part of is, as I've moved to different companies, is going through a rebrand for a new business. Like right now, we just did a big rebrand for Twilio, and it is such a journey it's almost like you get to just take this entity and break it apart and really look deep at the heart of what does it stand for? What's its why? How does it connect with other human beings? Why do they care about this? What are the stories and elements of all of that? And so for me, it's been fascinating to witness these transformations from big companies, because you're right. Like, as you learn different things and transform as a human, as an individual, that's one thing. But to get a brand to transform, the number of people that I have to get in line and believe a certain story and get to change their perception around it. I mean, it's hundreds and then thousands in the company and then millions, like, when it comes to like the customers and the press and the everything else, like, to get everyone to be on board that, oh, Twilio stands for the builder ethos, right? Now, like, this is just a totally new story. And it's just so fascinating for me to, like, the effort of getting that company to just change its narrative and then for everyone to accept and believe it. And right now, we've just finished that up over this last year, and it's been a phenomenal response of how everyone's accepting that. So I just love that. Like, that thrills me to no end. And now it's like, now how do I make that a part of culture and geek culture and dev culture? And it's just such a fascinating puzzle and challenge. So that transformation is really cool.
There was a moment here, I think this is like 2005, 2006. And a couple of us had agreed to get interviewed for a paper or a magazine that a Columbia professor was working on. And in exchange, he said, hey, you know, I do consulting. I will do free consulting if you're interested. And we were having a conversation around our pricing. And we're like, we've always been very inexpensive. We've always been close to movie theater prices. Is that right? You know, how we know our audience, these are assumptions that we've got. He's like, great, I'm actually good at that. He had been with Disney for years. So he goes away, he does his interviews and he does his research, and he comes back and blew us away in a room because he blew up every assumption that we were walking around with. We're like, well, you know, we're very fairly priced. And he's like, well, when you say fairly priced, like, what are you talking about? I go, well, we have like one price, it's this and that. And he goes, well, I have research here that shows you have 17 different prices. And he was going to different websites and different, and I'm like, okay. And he's like, and what is your zip code? Because we're like, you know, we feel like we have this blue collar audience. And he's like, you're essentially the Gold Coast of Chicago, which is one of the most expensive zip codes in the world. And like, you can imagine, right? We're like the experts at Second City. Yeah, like, oops again. And he was completely right. Now, you know, this is, again, where data and emotion are both important, because there's an emotional connection that people have to Second City, which is much closer to our story than the data might suggest. But it did, at the right time in my career, was like, oh, what if everything I knew was wrong, or, you know, wrong-ish, And then
or
I'm going to
like
that,
20 years before or whatever it was.
Or from 20 years before. And now we're living in a completely other, you know, world that we're going through this again, which again, the key to sort of sustained success, I think, is the calluses you get over time, recognizing that just because you're wrong now doesn't mean you're not going to be right tomorrow. It also means you're going to be wrong again. And for human beings, that is a tough pill to swallow.
Oh, it is. We're predictably irrational, and Danny Ariely says, right? Like, it's,
yes, we're
it's,
predictably irrational. Yeah.
We think we're so logical and so smart. And
but then the gift of knowing that is knowing that your audience is in the same boat. So what can you feed them at different times? Mm. And you wonder, you know, like, does a Ted Lasso become successful if it were done 5 years earlier or 5 years later? I don't think it necessarily does. It was scratching a very particular itch. We'll see what the new season brings us. But all of that stuff, everything has a shelf life.
Yep.
And,
yep.
You know, working with young talent here, and I've done it for so long that I'm like, it is so rare that you can stay at the top in your industry decade after decade after decade. I mean, Martin Short is experiencing his greatest success right now in his 70s. Than he had with SCTV back in the day, and then Saturday Night Live briefly. And it's like you can't write that, you can't plot that. But what you can do, and this is the thing about Marty, and if you haven't seen the documentary that's out about him, it's fantastic, because he is just such a person who was always truly present in the moment wherever he was. And that meant dealing with tragedy, that meant dealing with success, it meant dealing with failure, a lot of failure. But he kept presence. And then the other big thing that Marty was always great at is recognizing that his relationships meant everything to him. And so, you know, he always had these fantastic friends who love him and supported him. They happened to be Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks, you know, like, so that's not bad. But it was not because they were famous. It was because they were friends.
Yeah. Good people. I love it.
Tell me about that aspect of relationship building as it relates to the business of being creative. Because to me, it's kind of lives and dies with
100%. What's interesting is, so as I've analyzed and taught and helped with the topic of creative leadership for years and years, there are a lot of people who get into the industry and do it the right way. Like, that's how I started out. It's all about the craft. You're into writing or design or videography or whatever the creative pursuit it is that you're trying to make a living and still keep that creative spirit going. And when you start to move up into more of a leadership position, I think everyone has the assumption that, oh, when you're a creative leader or creative director, your main job is to just direct other people and tell them what to do. And it's like, I've got so much experience with creativity. Here, you go do this. And if I had to put a scale of the 10 different things that a creative leader does, I would put creative direction and doing the craft as 9 and 10 on the list.
Yeah.
And it's the opposite of what everyone thinks. They think, oh, if you go out there and do searches for what does it mean to be creative director, it's like they you know, glorify that. In all the movies, they glorify it. But the reality is, 1 through 8 is a completely different list of things. And number 1 is building relationships at the top. And it's all about, like, if you don't have the right connections with humans and the ability to sell and share and pitch ideas and trust, there is no environment where a good idea can survive. It's just part of it. You have to have, and here's my rule of thumb of, like, do I have a good enough relationship? And I don't know what it's like in your world, but in mine, in business and big companies, it's because everyone will all think, oh, yeah, I build relationships, I've got them. But the true test is, do you get invited to the meetings without asking?
Yeah.
Are you invited to the table without asking? Because if you are, then you have a relationship. Then they trust you. They want your opinion. They want your ideas. And it should be something that you don't have to push for. And if you are, and you're worming your way into these conversations, then you don't have a relationship.
This is the curse and blessing of having written the Yes And book, which is, it has just happened to me, which is a client came with an idea. The idea challenges basically what we normally do. And I get asked to weigh in, and my every instinct is saying no to this. And then literally someone goes, aren't you the Yes And guy? I'm like, okay.
Throw it in your face. Oh, suckalicious.
So if I'm Yes Anding, I'm saying, and indeed it took 20 minutes for me to end up in another office going, all right, yeah. And if we did this and this and this, yeah. And I think we could protect the brand if we did that. And oh yeah, that connects to this idea. And it also causes great humility because the people I'm talking to don't nearly have my pedigree or my experience. But they also, because of our relationship, they respect me and I respect them. And I have always been someone who's willing to change my mind, want a contrary opinion in the room. To me, that's all the fun stuff. And it just becomes so much less fun when you can't battle in the best possible way. Mm-hmm. And I know you say this in the book somewhere where you're like, I don't think this stuff is a war zone. And I agree with you. I think when I talk about battle, I'm talking about like the best kind of like
of ideas, battle of ideas. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And that only gets stronger when people can challenge each other. And then the ability to laugh through it, because that's kind of why we do that thing, evolutionarily speaking. But it's not something you talked about. You get the position and that doesn't change, or the thing that changes is actually the opposite. You have to become more humble and have more humility. Same thing with age, which is like, it's not, you know, and in fact, the curse of knowledge is real. You have to continually battle the fact that you have this position, this title, that someone will probably just sort of say, well, I guess he knows better. Mm. And guess what? He doesn't know better. We probably know better.
Yeah, that's fair. I love that you bring up the whole battle thing too, because for me, there are so many folks in business that do treat it like an us and them situation. And I really have this philosophy that I think everyone's creative. After doing all the neuroscience, writing the book, like deep down, we all have the same brain. There isn't someone who's, you know, an engineer that goes off and has like a completely different set of, you know, goo up there in their head. No, like we have all the same brain, and it's just a matter of what we're training ourselves to focus on at the time. But every human being has creativity. Every human being is creative. It's very different of how they make decisions and how they decide to not go work out this morning because they're lazy or whatever. You know, it's like non-logical moments that we have those creative leaps. And so for me, it's a matter of like, how can I train or expose this person to enough content that they'll get it and be on the same side as me. So it's not a battle. It's a sharing of ideas and getting to the point where everyone collectively is on the same page. So that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. And I think to that point, we do all share these characteristics, and the challenge is society, for reasons that I understand, has needed to make categories. And so you've got the like, hey, it's the work category or the home category. And I don't know. I was just like, because I lived in a world where my dad, who hosted a radio show and a TV show in Chicago for 32 years, you know, like when he came home, he was kind of the same person that he was on the radio and he was at home. He brought those ideas with him. He's like, oh, have you heard this piece of music, or have you seen this, or I had this conversation, or I read this book or whatever. And I never saw the distinctions. So I was able to sort of be like, well, that's the way it should be. And and so when I ended up, I mean, my first gig at Second City was as a dishwasher here in 1988. I mean, I knew I wanted to be in the industry. I just didn't know what part or how that was going to work. And what a gift to be able to like just be like on the bar staff, kind of watching the shows and the actors, but also knowing everyone around me wanted that same thing. And I didn't want to be on the stage. So it took some pressure off, but it was that ability to sort of be like, okay, everything I know or I read or I learn, I can bring in to this workplace and have it be my particular superpower. That is true for everyone. And I just feel like for so many people, they need or feel they need to keep the distinction and the walls down. And I bet your experience is the same, is that you bring in the thing that you,
Here, a funny thing, even like I read leadership books and they say at some point you need to have a, some distance between you and your employees, because when it comes time to make the hard decisions, if you have to fire someone, you need to be able to make the right choice. And I disagree with that philosophy completely. I mean, if I think about it, I'm on this flying rock for I don't know how long, and mm-hmm. there are times that I'm hanging out with my coworkers more than my extended family, mm-hmm. much more. And so why can't I have a deep personal relationship with them? Why can't I be friends? And so that's been my philosophy of, like, I still have like writing retreats. We'll go away to a cabin and write on our books or whatever it is for a long weekend. And it's people from all my past jobs where I've been their manager or their coworker, and we're still, you know, connecting. Even someone who I fired years ago at an agency will still show up to these things, because those relationships are so, so important. And it goes beyond just, you know, title and time at a certain location.
You got to wonder, the person giving the advice of, like, don't be friends with the people you work with, like, how sad is your situation yeah. that you think that is true? And that is like, and it's like, and again, it's also like the misunderstanding around empathy. It's this idea of like, well, you know, Paul Bloom was on the podcast with his book Against Empathy, and I love Paul, and it's a provocative title, and the book is great, mm-hmm. but also sort of being like, it's a tough thing to pitch. And it's the assumption that somehow if you're empathetic, you're not going to truly understand or be able to help. And I'm like, that doesn't need to be the case. You can. No. Care all you want and still have to fire someone.
Totally.
In fact, I have the same thing. I have fired so many people who are some of my best friends in the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. Listen, we always end the podcast by asking for a yes and story. I'm very excited to hear what you might have for us.
All right. Here's my, as I was thinking about it, here's a fun yes and. So years ago, when I was in the agency, we had a client and he was the son of the governor of the state. Okay. And he came to me and said, hey, I want to have a group of friends come up to the governor's mansion for like a, I don't know, Halloween dinner party. Can you make me an invite? Can you design me an invite? And my first thought was like, really? You want me to do your damn invite? Like, you can figure this out. Like, you don't need to have me waste my time on that. And I thought about it. And then I was like, wait a second. Maybe we can turn this into something interesting. Because I oftentimes like to make experiences that are just a little bit not usual. So I said, okay, yes, I'll make the invite, but you need to give me access to this mansion beforehand, because I've got some ideas. Because this mansion was known for like some good ghost stories. So I went around and basically they were going to give a tour of the house beforehand and tell some of the stories. So I took my 11-year-old and we went and did a photo shoot. Maybe she was younger. Maybe she was like 8, of this little girl in the white dress. And I added pictures on the walls around this house and took footage from the security cameras. And we got the Secret Service involved, so that as the people were going around and watching, they told the story of this little girl who had died in the house. And as they're going around, I'm changing the photos out with different mm-hmm. photos on the wall. So as they walk past, it's slightly changing, right? And then I get the security folks to show a video that they caught once on video, which is like this little ghost girl walking past, and they all, oh, it's the girl on the walls. We totally see her. You know, it's like using, you know, what would you say? Like an authority figure to tell truth, even though it was a total lie. And then let them all up to the ballroom in this moment where there's this trap door. And we did this trick with the lights that flickered in and out. And then all of a sudden the girl appears there at the end of the hallway and scared the crap out of all of these people, like screaming and running away, and then flickers and she goes to the trap door and then she's gone. Right. So it was just this fun ghost story. And then I hired a whole troupe of like local actors from the community college and did a murder mystery. Once they figured out that it was all fake, to go from room to room and talk to these actors to figure out who killed the little girl and how it all worked out. Anyhow, it was just a great evening of just like this whole moment that could just be a huge story around, you know, kind of this dead ghost girl. But it was all just because I was supposed to do an invite and just design someone an invite. So it was super fun.
That's the best, because, I mean, you have the story. So like one of the things is you got the story. You created delight and awe and all these things for other people. And, you know, you just did it. And I think, you know, we've interviewed Dan Pink's last book, I believe, was about regret. And he talked about the fact that you rarely regret the things that you do. You regret the things that you don't do.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that idea, right? Of just like, I'm going to do it. And then it became great. And it's like,
if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it big.
Yeah. And then, and what you don't know is who is the person who saw that, who's like, I'm going to hire that person. I'm going to seek out it. Or even better, tells the story behind your back about what this person did. And then, it's you. Adam Morgan is the director of brand marketing at Twilio. He's got a great book. It's called Sorry Spock, Emotions Drive Business. Hey, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks for bringing me. This is a pleasure. Thank you.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.